today's people, today's music, or today's Johannesburg. Welcome to Radio Today.
Today proudly presents In Town Tonight. This live recording of the 2010 Steve Biko Bioethics Lecture is brought to you on Radio Today by the University of the Witwatersrand Faculty of Health Sciences, the Steve Biko Center for Bioethics, and the Johannesburg Holocaust and Genocide Center. In Town Tonight is made possible through the generosity of the Teco Cooper Valley Trust. Radio Today. Today's radio. Today.
Good afternoon, colleagues, and some of my seniors that I see around here. I'm really pleased to be welcoming all of you, and especially Tali Nates, I'm doing this as the chairperson of the advisory board of the Biko Center for Bioethics. And we welcome you on behalf of the center itself, as well as our Faculty of Health Sciences. Now, as you are aware, this is the 33rd anniversary of the death of a great political activist, Steve Bantu Biko. And as many of you are aware, that he was in fact, he died on September the 12th, 1977, and he died following assaults and torture by the apartheid state security police. Now, Steve Biko, and many of you may be aware of all this, was the most prominent political activist and, I believe, a political visionary in the 1960s and 70s. His teaching and leadership inspired many other political activists who are now political leaders in our country. His death had tremendous impact locally as well as internationally, more so than many others who died in detention. There are very many reasons for this. Now, Steve Biko's death highlighted the extent the apartheid regime was prepared to go to uphold its oppressive policies and sustain white supremacy in our country. It further illustrated the practice of torture against political opponents, and importantly, medical complicity in such practice. And this occurred at an individual level from the doctors that were involved, as well as at an organizational level, various organizations such as the health, which was the South African Medical and Dental Council at that time, as well as the Medical Association of South Africa. For us in the medical profession, the circumstances relating to the medical care of Steve Biko was subject to, the medical care that he was subject to and he received while suffering from serious injuries inflicted by the security police, there are lessons to be learned. Foremost of these is that We cannot subordinate the interest and welfare of our patients to those of authorities, influences, or other interests. Neither should we turn a blind eye to the present circumstances patients at our hospitals are subject to. This also extends to our important advocacy obligation on behalf of our disempowered patients. Our facility here at WITS has a record of involvement in what is regarded as the BECO case, which in fact led to the establishment of the Professional and Ethical Standards Committee, and this was during the period of Professor Tobias's deanship. And that is when this committee was formed and associated with him very strongly over the years, and in this matter was Professor Trevor Jenkins. It is consequently appropriate that our guest speaker this afternoon is Tally Nates, who will present a paper on health and human rights, perpetrators, bystanders, and rescuers, portraits of moral choice. Now, Tally Nates is highly committed to the advancement human rights, reconciliation, Holocaust education, and genocide prevention. She has lectured internationally on these issues and has presented at many conferences. She has led numerous educational missions to Eastern Europe and Rwanda. Tally was born to a family of Holocaust survivors. Her father and uncle were both saved by Oskar Schindler, but the rest of the family perished. Tally, we look forward to your presentation.
Honored guests, today, 33 years ago, on the 12th of September, Stephen Bantu Biko died. On the 14th of September, the Rand Daily Mail carried the report of his death, quoting a statement from Minister of Justice, then Mr. James Kruger, issued the previous day. Since 5 September, Mr. Biko refused his meals and threatened to go on a hunger strike. He had been regularly supplied with meals and water, but refused to partake thereof. On 7th of September, a district surgeon was called in because Mr. Biko appeared unwell. The district surgeon certified that he could find nothing wrong with Mr. Biko. On 8th September, the police again arranged for district surgeon and the chief district surgeon to examine Mr. Biko, and because they could diagnose no physical problem, they arranged that he be taken to the prison hospital for intensive examination. On the same day, a specialist examined him. The following morning, he was again examined by a doctor and kept at the hospital for observation. On Sunday morning, 11 September, Mr. Biko was removed from the prison hospital to Warmer Police Station on the recommendation of the district surgeon. He still had not eaten on Sunday afternoon and again appeared unwell. After consultation with the district surgeon, it was decided to transfer him to Pretoria. He was taken to Pretoria that same night. On 12 September, Mr. Biko was again examined by district surgeon in Pretoria and received medical treatment. He died on Sunday night. So many doctors, so many examinations, and still Steve Biko died that night. On 14th September, Minister Kruger addressed the Nationalist Party Congress saying his now infamous words, "I'm not glad and I'm not sorry about Mr. Biko. It leaves me cold." So, we are here asking ourselves, what was the role of the doctors in Steve Biko's case and death? On their admission, their own admission, they never attempted to give or obtain for Biko any form of medical treatment. And perhaps we expect less of the police, perhaps we expect less from those that try to keep the apartheid system going. But what about the doctors? What about the Hippocratic Oath. Only in July 1985, the South African Medical and Dental Council finally held disciplinary hearings against the doctors who had treated Biko, and two physicians were found guilty of improper behavior, Dr. Ivor Lang and Dr. Benjamin Tucker. Tucker was eventually stripped of his medical qualifications, and Lang received a caution and reprimand. So, indeed, the doctors were found to be perpetrators. They made their choices that cost Biko's life. And the talk that I'm going to deliver to you today will be about choices. About choices of perpetrators, of bystanders, of rescuers. And I will take a case study of Nazi Germany and the Holocaust, where we will examine some of those moral choices. We will examine portraits of some perpetrators, bystanders, and rescuers. And I will ask you to keep in the back of your mind some questions that I will ask you to reflect on as I speak and as I give you those portraits. Who is a perpetrator? Is a perpetrator only someone that kills? And how many does he have to kill? One? 1,000? 900,000? If the law of the state permits one to kill, can the person be regarded as a perpetrator? Could a perpetrator refuse an order of the state? Can he or she say they were just following orders and then commit the crime? When we look at the bystanders, what were the choices of the bystanders? And these are the majority of the population in any given time. Apartheid South Africa, the case today is also the case. So who are those bystanders? And is a bystander choice assist the victim or the perpetrator? And I will argue that the bystander's choice always assists the perpetrator, never the victim. And we will look at perhaps a new word for all of you, upstanders. It's a word coined a few years ago to describe the opposite of a bystander, someone that stands up against oppression, against immoral acts, and perhaps they take their action through rescue, through resistance to oppression. And we will look at these examples while I ask you to think of the questions I posed. I will start with this quite famous picture taken on the ramp in Auschwitz-Birkenau, perhaps the most notorious and biggest death camp in Poland, run by the Nazi regime. And in this picture, you see Hungarian Jewish men, women, and children from Berehovo ghetto and the surrounding Hungary, from Hungary, on arrival. Sometime in late May or beginning of June 1944. And the picture is taken from the Auschwitz album. Before I explain to you what is the Auschwitz album and explain a bit more about the context of this picture, just have a look at the picture and you will see on the ramp in Birkenau a train full of human cargo, human victims arrive, men, women and children being selected to death or life by medical doctors. SS doctors standing on the ramp every day and doing this selective process. In the picture, you'll see the perpetrators in their uniform. You'll also see the victims. We don't know if there are any upstanders in this picture, but we'll talk about them a little bit later. But is there a bystander? Is there a bystander in the picture? And actually there is. Who is taking the picture? The person standing on top of the roof of the train. The photographer, in this case, was a bystander. The Auschwitz album was a collection of 193 pictures taken by one SS person. We're not sure who, there are a few possibilities, and collected from the moment the transport of Jewish victims arrived to Auschwitz-Birkenau to the end of the process. 193 photographs. Photographs of selection, and in every selection, 80% of each deportation was chosen by the doctors to go to their death. 80% of every deportation went immediately, within few hours, to the gas chambers and perished. Only 20% of a train load will then be processed for hard labor, for slave labor. They will be tattooed, they will be given uniform, and they will work. And many of them did not survive more than 3 months at the most. The process was secretive. So these are some of the only pictures that we have of that process. And how do we have them? We have them because a woman, young woman, 18 years old woman, Lily Jacobs, was one of those people on the ramp. She was chosen to work. She worked in Auschwitz, then she was sent to another concentration camp, Dora Mittelbau. And in the end of the war, after liberation, she was in a haze, she was walking around, walking inside one of the SS barracks, looking on the table, finding an album, an actual photo album, looking at the album and finding a picture of herself standing in Auschwitz, and then finding pictures of her family, including her two young brothers, her mother, her grandmother, all who were murdered that day in late May, beginning of June 1944 in Auschwitz-Birkenau. Lily Jacob took the album with her and kept it for a very, very long time until she gave it as a donation to the archives of the Yad Vashem Museum. So what happened in Auschwitz-Birkenau? What happened on the ramp? And what was the role of the doctors in that process? A picture of Auschwitz today, a few months ago, green and threatening, still standing, the railway track, the watchtowers, and the same ramp, the ramps where 30 doctors, SS doctors, performed selections of human beings and chose them to live or die in just one wave of the finger. Left was death, right was life, even if temporary. One of the most notorious of all was, of course, Dr. Joseph Mengele. Again, a picture of selection from the same Auschwitz album. Again, the doctors standing in front, smoking, talking. They're working. It's a day's work in that planet that was the genocide planet of Auschwitz. And Joseph Mengele was just one of those 30 doctors. But was he just one of those 30 doctors? Who was he? He joined the Nazi Party in 1937, and very quickly he joined the SS. And actually, he joined the Waffen-SS, that was the most extreme and militaristic form of the SS. He fought in the Eastern Front very bravely, and actually was injured. And in 1943, he was then sent to Auschwitz-Birkenau. He had great interest in research into twins and how twins are what they are. He really was very, very interested in that. So very quickly, as he arrived in Auschwitz-Birkenau, he became the chief camp physician of Birkenau, and like other doctors, he participated in the selection. But he was on the ramp every day. He was on the ramp even when he was off duty. Why? He was looking for twins. He was searching for test subjects for his experiments. And he found them. He found twins. He found other abnormalities that he was interested in, specifically Jewish victims and Roma, what we call gypsy victims. And in Auschwitz, he had full license to do whatever he wanted. He could do experiments without anesthetic. He could maim. He could actually do anything that he imagined. There was no restriction. Everything was allowed. So he performed a broad range of agonizing and often lethal experiments with Jewish and Roma twins, most of them children. He had a wide variety of other interests, by the way. Maybe he's less known for them, but he was interested in people that had two different eye colors, heterochromia condition, very interested in that. He was also interested in gangrene patients, people that had Noma disease. He was embracing all sorts of pseudo-scientific experiments and believed in the National Socialist theory of eugenics, that there are fitter people and less fit people. He really tried to demonstrate that the Aryan race is better than the inferior races, the Gypsies and the Jews. Sadly, many of his test subjects died as a result of the experimentation. And after that, he will do a post-mortem examination on them and even keep some body parts for a research paper that he wanted to publish after the war. All in all, just in 1944, he had 3,000 children, twins, under his care. Of them, in January 1945, at the liberation of Auschwitz by the Red Army, 18th of January 1945, less than 200 of them survived. We were actually fortunate in South Africa to meet two of the twins that survived. University of Cape Town had a visit in 2008 by Eva Moses Kerr, that was with her twin sister Miriam. Both survived the experiments of Mengele on twins. And here in Johannesburg in 2007, we had another test subject, Marta Weiss, that survived with her sister, Eva. Mengele made a mistake. They were sisters. They were not twins. He still did all the experiments on them nevertheless. We will move to another story, this time not in Poland, but in Germany. Sachsenhausen concentration camp was one of the first concentration camps, built in 1936, housed many political prisoners, objectors of the Nazi party. Mainly in Sachsenhausen, there were actually German and other prisoners, not many Jews as such. Until the end, there were not many Jews that were interned in Sachsenhausen. And Sachsenhausen was also the camp that maybe if you watched the movie The Counterfeiters, if you did, that was the camp where the forgery of the pound and the dollar took place. So just to put us in this picture, what Sachsenhausen was. A week and a half ago, I took this picture. I was actually in a conference in Germany and spend the day in Sachsenhausen. This is an original barrack of 1936, the oldest barrack to survive intact in Germany from the time of the concentration camps. And it is the barrack of the infirmary, the hospital of the Sachsenhausen concentration camp. SS doctors in this barrack and in five other barracks of the hospital committed actually medical murder. There's no other words to explain what was going on in a hospital. When we think of a hospital, we don't think of experiments, we don't think of selection, we don't think of murder. But what happened inside this barrack was medicine without humanity. What happened in this barrack was that in 800 beds of the six different homes, you had 2,000 patients. What happened inside this infirmary? Many horrible things. From one point of view, strangely enough, because Sachsenhausen is half an hour from Berlin, Sachsenhausen and the infirmary was a propaganda tool. They were bringing even journalists to Sachsenhausen, to the barrack, to see what's going on, to take pictures. Of course, at that stage, they will clean the barrack. They will, you know, kill the people that were over the limit of the 800 beds, and people will be able to come and visit. But what else happened in Sachsenhausen? There was selection and murder. During the war, Himmler gave an order that every capable person has to work. So in other words, if you are injured or sick and you come to the infirmary to get better, if the doctors can heal you, fine, you can go back to work and you can be used. If they cannot heal you, you will be selected to death. And 2,000, mainly German, inmates were murdered just because they were not fit for work. What else happened in those barracks? Sterilization and castration of mainly homosexuals and inferior, again, people that were regarded inferior in racial, genetic term, biological ground. What else happened in Sachsenhausen infirmary? There was a program from 1941, I'll speak about it a little bit later, of euthanasia, where 550 supposedly ill people were murdered. Here, in Sachsenhausen, the program was called 14F13. But what also happened in Sachsenhausen were medical experiments. And all sorts of medical experiments, from poison ammunition that was used on inmates to check the effects of mustard gas poisoning, to performance-enhancing medication that was given to inmates. Really experiments that had no scientific value, but that maimed and killed most of the inmates that went through it, of course, without giving any consent or permission to go through the experiments. I'm going to look at one such doctor. Dr. Dorman, Arnold Dorman, perhaps not known to you because a lot of the material about him came after the archives in the Soviet Union, the Russia, opened up, and a lot of the material came out in the last few years. Who was Dr. Dorman? He was a promising young scientist. He was interested in internal medicine, and he learned the technique of virus and tissue breeding. Dorman joined the Nazi Party in 1937, then he joined the Wehrmacht, the army. Then he fought in France and in Russia. While he was in France in 1940, he noticed many cases of jaundice, that many soldiers in the Wehrmacht suffered from jaundice, and he started to suspect that jaundice was an infectious disease. So he went in 1942 to Greece, and where he examined hundreds of hepatitis patients and gathered punctured tissue from them. In May 1943, after many, many years of collecting tissue and experimenting on lab animals and so on, Dr. Dorman was summoned to Dr. Karl Brandt's office. Dr. Karl Brandt was Hitler's physician, personal physician, but he was also the commissioner of sanitation and health in the Reich. And he asked Dr. Dorman to report on his findings on the success in breeding the pathogen isolated from the liver tissue of jaundice patients. And Dorman was so excited. He was so excited about the invitation. The closest person to Hitler is inviting him personally to come to talk to him. And he wrote a letter to his mother. And we have the letter, and we have also her response. And in the letter, he tells his mother, "All I now need is the final proof that this material really was the pathogen causing jaundice infection." So his mother is very, very proud, and he goes to Dr. Brandt to meet him. And he tells him about his experiments on lab animals that develop jaundice symptoms. And Brandt is very excited, but then Dorman tells him, "But the proof that this pathogen really was the cause of hepatitis in humans was only possible by transmitting it to humans." Brandt said, "No problem. You need humans for experiments? Well, we have plenty of those." And he writes to Himmler, and he asks for test humans for the hepatitis trial. And Himmler, Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS, gave Dorman a permission, even though that in the letter to Himmler, the letter stated fatalities are to be expected. It is on the letter. Himmler immediately answered back, and he gave Dorman the permission, and he said in his letter, "You can use 8 Jews under sentence of death from Auschwitz camp for your experiments." So Dorman goes to Auschwitz. He goes to Auschwitz in June 1943. He spends 3 days in Auschwitz with Joseph Mengele, that we met before. And he stands on the ramp during selection, and he chooses, by the way, he stands with his Wehrmacht uniform that you can see here very proudly, and he selects children and young men, and he selects 11 children and young men from the selection. Himmler allowed him 8 adults. He chooses 11 children, believing the children have more of a chance not to have suffered from jaundice, so he can try his experiments more successfully on them. And how he tests the fact that they had jaundice or not, he asked the children, as he takes them out of the selection, he said to them, "Have you had jaundice? Have you had jaundice?" But the kids are from Bejan ghetto in Poland, and they don't speak German. So he shows the yellow star on their clothes, and he says, "Yellow, yellow, did you have jaundice? And were you yellow in your face?" And some of them are saying no, some are not understanding, and in the end he selects the 11, and they of course take blood samples from them that they check for typhus fever antibodies, and they send all 11 to Sachsenhausen. This is a list of the 11. Actually, there were 12 to start, but they went down to 11, and 11 that did not have typhus antibodies were sent to Sachsenhausen. This is just one of them, Salomon Feldberg, and 10 others. The age of the young victims were, the youngest was 8 years old, the oldest was 23 years old, and they arrived in Sachsenhausen in August 43, and he started experiments only a year later, in September 44, but not because he was good-hearted in any way. It was really because in an air bomb Allied air bomb raid in late 43, all his samples were destroyed. So he had to redo the whole pathogen experiments again, and only in summer of 44 it was ready. This is the room, room number 51 in Sachsenhausen, where all 11 men and young boys were kept for almost 2 years. Dorman examined them every day. He gave them the experimental injections and performed liver punctures on them daily. But they survived. All 11 survived the experiments. How come they survived? We need to look for the upstander. Because you don't survive as an 8-year-old experiments in Sachsenhausen concentration camp without upstanders to do this. This is one of them. Per Roth, Norwegian medical assistant, together with two of his colleagues, both Norwegians, both doctors, Dr. Sven Oftedal and Dr. Per Grassley, that protected the 11 boys all the time. They gave them food, they gave them rations, they went to check on them all the time, they saw that they survived the 2 years. But they did more than that. In the end, in April 1945, the Red Army was coming to Sachsenhausen and the SS was retreating. Dorman was nowhere to be seen. He disappeared. The SS was about to execute the 11 boys. The three Norwegian came to the SS and said, "What are you going to do? The experiments, they will be all lost, all void. If you kill the boys, Dr. Dorman will be very, very upset." So they didn't kill the 11 boys. They saved their life. And then they protected them through the death march from Sachsenhausen to inside Germany to Mecklenburg, where they were liberated in May 1945. And ironically, the 11 boys that were experimented on survived. Their families that were taken to Auschwitz-Birkenau did not. Only two siblings of the 11 boys survived the Holocaust. I want to touch briefly the euthanasia program and the role of the doctors in that program, because, of course, we mentioned it with the 14F13 program, the 550 men murdered in Sachsenhausen, but what was the euthanasia, the T4 program? And I think for me, this is the most horrific role of doctors in all of this period of the Second World War and the Holocaust. Because the euthanasia, the euphemistic term of the secret murder program, which targeted for systematic killing mentally and physically disabled patients in Germany and Austria, German children, German adults that were murdered. Why? Because they were not perfect. They were regarded by the Nazi regime as a burden, financial burden, genetic burden, and they had to disappear. And who will make them disappear? Doctors, nurses. And again, that connection to Biko and to Jimmy Kruger and the whole thing of doctors that's supposed to save lives, yet take lives. We again see doctors that are managing a whole process of killing in six hospitals or clinics around Germany and Austria, where children and adults come to be guests in those clinics. And then they're cremated. The urn full of ashes, random ash, is sent to their families, and a death certificate, fraudulent death certificate, with a fraudulent cause of death sent to the families. And this was supposed to be a secret program, but of course, when parents are getting an urn with a death certificate, people will talk. So they started to talk. And the secret came out. When The Secret came out in August 41, Hitler officially said that this program is going to come to an end. But it was only official, because unofficially, the program continued until the end of the war. Until 1941, 70,273 children and adults, German and Austrian children and adults, were murdered in special gas chambers by carbon monoxide, cremated until 1941. Until 1945, in many programs such as the 14F-13, additional 200,000 were murdered. And we are talking about anything, the numbers are not clear because many of them were not registered, but anything between 200 and 300,000 that were murdered by doctors, by nurses, and by medical staff that were given amnesty by Hitler. Already in September, October 1939, Adolf Hitler signed a secret authorization in order to protect participating physicians, medical staff, and an administrator from prosecution. So, what are we looking at? We're looking at people. People like Franz Stengel, that perhaps none of you ever heard of, that is responsible for the deaths of 900,000 people. 900,000 people. How do we even start looking at a person like that? So who is Franz Stengel? A normal person, ordinary man. He is not a monster. He is a policeman. A young age he joins, he's from Austria, a young age he joins the police, and he's offered a promotion to be a head of police of the euthanasia program in Austria, in Linz. And he says yes. And then he does his job so well that they give him another promotion. This time, he is the head of Schloss Hartheim, Castle Hartheim, one of the six guest institutions where the euthanasia program was carried out. And in Hartheim, 18,269 people, disabled mentally and physically, are murdered. And he's doing his job so very well that when the final solution of the Jewish problem, the death camps, are starting to operate in Poland, he's then sent first to Sobibor death camp and then to Treblinka. And in Treblinka, he is there for a year and he's doing such an organized job that he is regarded as the best commandant in Poland, killing 900,000 or more under his care. After the war, he escaped to Brazil, but he was found in 1967, extradited to Germany, put on trial in Düsseldorf, and found guilty, of course, set in prison for 6 months and then died of a heart failure. While in prison, Gita Sereny, herself a refugee from Germany, wrote a book that I recommend to all of you that want to try and understand the mind of a perpetrator. It's called Into That Darkness. She interviews Franz Stengel and she asks him about that year in Treblinka, and she asks him, would it be true to say that you got used to the liquidations, to the killings? And I'll read to you because it's so interesting what he said. He thought for a moment. To tell the truth, he then said slowly and thoughtfully, one did become used to it. And she said, would it be true to say that you finally felt they weren't really human beings? And he answers, when I was on a trip once, years later, in Brazil, he said, face deeply concentrated and obviously reliving the experience, my train stopped next to a slaughterhouse. The cattle in the pens, hearing the noise of the train, trotted up to the fence and stared at the train. They were very close to my window one crowding the other, looking at me through that fence. I thought then, look at this. This reminds me of Poland. That's just how the people looked, trustingly, just before they went into the tins, the gas chambers. I couldn't eat tinned meat after that, he says. Those big eyes, which looked at me, not knowing that in no time at all, they'd all be dead. He paused. His face was drawn. At this moment, he looked old and worn and real. Sugita Sereni says to him, so you didn't feel they were human beings? And he answered, cargo. He said tonelessly, they were cargo. And again, Jimmy Kruger, after Biko's death, says, it leaves me cold. They were not human beings in the eyes of the perpetrator. But that's the reason it's so important to actually look at us, to look at us as bystanders. And it is important to look at bystanders during human rights abuses, during the apartheid period, during the Holocaust, during the Rwanda genocide, because it's easier to look at Franz Stengel and say, well, this is abnormal. I cannot be that. But the bystanders, those that stand by and see everything unfolding and don't say a word, what about them? Primo Levi, one of the survivors and great writers of the Holocaust, said, in spite of the varied possibilities for information, most Germans didn't know because they didn't want to know, because indeed they wanted not to know. Wanted not to know. This is a bystander. A bystander in Germany is the neighbor, the community, the kids at school, the teachers, the people that are seeing in 1942 a deportation of Jews in broad daylight from their town, going with suitcases and not saying a word. The people that in 1935, when the laws came and said that you are not allowed to go to your normal doctor if he is Jewish. But I went to this doctor for 20 years. Why don't I go to the same doctor? You are not allowed to go to the same doctor. He is Jewish. And they're not questioning. They just go to another doctor. They were the bystanders that allowed Franz Stengel to be in this world, that allowed Arnold Dorman to be in this world. So luckily, we have also the upstanders. And the upstanders are also ordinary human beings, like you and me. They are normal, but they do something perhaps extraordinary. They save lives. They rescue. They resist. And they come from everywhere, from Japan, Chinua Sugiyara, from Poland, from Russia, from Portugal, from the United States, from Holland, and the bigger picture of someone living here in Pretoria, Jaap van Prustig in his young days, and Jaap van Prustig, who was a lawyer in Holland that saved dozens and dozens of Jews by forging baptismal papers and declaring that they are Christians and not Jews, and saving their lives. And I asked him a few years ago, I said to him, how did you do it? Why did you do it? He looked at me as if I'm absolutely crazy, and he said, what do you mean? When you see a person drowning, wouldn't you save the drowning man? So I didn't have the heart to tell him that I'm not a good swimmer. I will not, but George Bezos here is an excellent swimmer. You will save them. I will not. So for the upstander, standing up was not abnormal. For them, it was, a man is drowning. You jump and you save him. It was so simple. And actually, I'm alive because of one of them. Oskar Schindler, in his very famous list, saved my father and my uncle. So I'm alive because a German, a Nazi, made a choice to save 1,000 people. This is a copy of the list. It's not very clear, I'm afraid, but my father's name is there on page 10. His name was Moses Turner, and my uncle's name was Heinrich Turner, and both of them were saved by a man that started as a perpetrator. Think about it. Oskar Schindler joins the Nazi party. He takes a factory free from Jews. He uses slave labor, no scruples, making a buck. He's a perpetrator. But then something happens and he becomes a bystander. He looks on and he sees the deportation of the Jews from one of the ghettos in Poland, in Krakow. He's a bystander. He looks, he's not getting involved. But what he sees changes him. What he sees makes him decide that he's going to stand up and he's going to make a difference. And what does he do? Very famous list of 1,000 men, women, and children that he saves. He bribes his way, he gives his fortune. He takes them all to his camp that he established in Brunlitz, next to his hometown, and he saves their lives. And because of him, so many thousands more are alive. So it seems as if these are choices again that makes a huge difference to people's lives. So I want to maybe challenge all of us, because the choices are not easy. If it was easy, everyone will be an upstander. If I ask you now, and even if I ask myself, I would love to think that I will save someone. I would like to think that if I'm a doctor, I will say no to experiments. If I'm Dr. Dorman that is interested in internal medicine, I will say, no, I don't really want to test it on human beings. But we don't know that. So I will share with you that, finally, the story of Abba Kovner, that was a Jew living in Vilna in the ghetto, that was a resistance fighter. He was one of the heads of the resistance. He actually started the resistance in the East. He was part of the partisans or the resistance fighters in the forests of Lithuania, next to Vilna. But Abba Kovner then tells the story about him saying goodbye to his mother. He decided that he's going to fight. So he went to his mother, old mother, to say goodbye to her. He went to say goodbye and she begged him not to leave her. She said, I'm scared. Don't leave me. But he left her. And she was murdered. He became the hero of the resistance. Years later, he reflected back and he said, was I really the hero of the resistance? Or was I the coward that abandoned my mother when she needed me most? And for me, those are choiceless choices. And many of the portraits that I shared with you today are sharing with us those choiceless choices. I don't want to end without mentioning that the dilemmas of the Holocaust did not just end there, despite the fact that after the Holocaust we said never again, despite the fact that after the Holocaust the Declaration of Human Rights was written in the United Nations in 1948, that the Convention Against Genocide was passed in the United Nations in 1948, despite all that, genocide happened again and again. So many times, never again is never again until the next time. In one of my visits in Rwanda, I took a picture of in Tarama Church where 4,000 Tutsis were murdered by Hutu militias inside a church, a Catholic church. And on the bones, they put a sign, never again. But there I also met Silas that gives me and hopefully us hope. Because Silas was a soldier, Hutu soldier, that saved dozens of women and children, hiding them in his house, then taking them to Burundi and to safety. And again, I asked him the million-dollar question, why did you do it? And for him it was, listen, I'm a soldier. In a war, you fight men. The minute I saw that they're murdering women and children, it was wrong. I knew I had to do something. If we can just see things as simple as that, I think that will give us the answer. So, to conclude, looking back at the doctors who chose not to help the injured Steve Biko, and to the portraits we looked at today, and to the lessons of choices we spoke about, I want to end with a story from Sachsenhausen concentration camp of a veteran prisoner that used to tell new prisoners about the rules of the camp, of the difficulties they would have to endure, of the darkness that awaited them. He told it all honestly and directly, and he concluded his remarks with the words, "I have told you this story not to weaken you, but to strengthen you. Now it is up to you." And indeed, in the end, it is up to all of us. Thank you.
This live recording of the 2010 Steve Biko Bioethics Lecture was brought to you on radio today by the University of the Witwatersrand Faculty of Health Sciences, the Steve Biko Center for Bioethics, and the Johannesburg Holocaust and Genocide Center. In Town Tonight is made possible through the generosity of the Teco Copo Valley Trust. Radio today. Today's radio. Today.